Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating, just being here generally. Coming up on this week's episode, we're going to be talking about scientists that are AI made by AI scientists. A Gordian knot of an idea that is promising enough. The idea that an AI could actually figure out gaps in science, perform the research, test the answers, and then publish is actually not as wild as you might think. And what does it mean for the future of science? First, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from the University of Galway and from Trinity College Dublin, Professor Matthew Campbell. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Jessamine, as a female comedian, I challenge you with this one. Make this not so terrifying.
AMOC run amok.
Okay.
Yeah. It's okay. Like, all right, fine. So this story is about something that we've been hearing more about in recent months and years, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Current, which is, of course, an intrinsically funny name. But what it has to do with is in the Atlantic Ocean, warm water flowing sort of to the north in the North Atlantic on the top, the sort of broad, shallow part of the ocean, and then getting cold up north, sinking back down and going back down towards the equator.
Right off the coast of our country.
Right off the coast of our country. Local story, this. And it's part of a global network of ocean currents and these kind of conveyor belts that like process and effectively move heat through the ocean.
Enormous amounts of heat, enormous amounts of water, but surprisingly quick.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is a part of how global climate is constructed from these moving ocean currents. And where AMOC has been making the news recently is that there are predictions that it is starting to slow down. So this would have obviously huge implications for us if the flow of hot water through the ocean was to slow down. I mean, both Ireland specifically and Northern Europe in general, like we have much warmer climates than we kind of have the right to based on our latitude, which is great in some sense, but it's very much tied to this ocean circulation. So, and of course, no surprise here, but the reason for this is climate change. So in addition to, you know, global warming, ocean acidification, all this other really fun stuff that we love to talk about, this potential slowdown and what's more concerning, possible collapse of AMOC, of this overturning current, would have huge implications for the climate of Ireland, mainly in terms of the humidity and the storms that we experience. So potentially drier summers, wetter winters, but more extreme storms, which is already a consequence of climate change that we're kind of looking at. And something that's quite relevant, like to me out in Galway, to anyone that's living near the coast, but actually just to the country as a whole.
Are we not talking about like Independence Day or not Independence Day? What's the one with all the one in the future where all the everything turns to ice? What's that called?
Ice Bad Planet.
Yeah, that one.
Three. The Reckoning.
Are we not talking about that? Because I thought it was more significant than more storms and hotter and
well, it depends on where you are in the world, right? So the problem, too, is that all of these things are connected. So we could have differing temperatures from the AMOC collapsing, which, you know, mainly would be lowering the temperatures, but we're also seeing rising in temperatures from climate change and global warming. So for us, the temperature difference might not be as extreme as it would be in other parts of Europe, potentially. But the overall impact on our climate will be very bad.
Yeah. And this story has gone back and forth a bit. There was like, this was going to be really bad and it's going to happen really soon. And then there was like, nah, it's not. But now it looks like more evidence is pointing towards that actually being the worst case scenario.
Yeah. Well, so the thing that's surprising about this is I think the collapse of AMOC used to be considered, you know, a potentially high impact but low probability event. And now this new study, the one that's in the news this week, which came from the INRIA Research Center in Bordeaux, is basically adding new actual data sets from the observations of the Earth's oceans to the models that have been used to develop and understand what AMOC does, even though we can't observe it directly all the time. And unfortunately, now this slowdown is predicted to be much stronger than previously anticipated. The uncertainty around the prediction is smaller than it was before, so there's less of a chance that we're just kind of measuring it wrong or that the model is wrong. And it's considered very likely that basically by the end of the century in 2100, we'll be looking at a slowdown of 42% to 58%, which would pretty much guarantee a collapse of the current. Now, the thing is, the current has collapsed before. And so the way that we understand how to deal with this actually involves looking back at the past and what happened previously. One of my colleagues in Galway, Dr. Audrey Morley, studies this by looking at the records of ocean currents in the past. And I think this is actually a space where Ireland could potentially be a leader in terms of both the science and the mitigation, if we just pay attention to it and don't stick our heads in the sand.
Yeah, but mitigation of this sort of level of climatic change, there's only so much you can really do, right? I mean, like,
it requires
how do you mitigate
collaboration.
The, with God, I would imagine. Right. Our second story, Matthew, is a slightly more upbeat one. It's to do with the Epstein-Barr virus. Now, this became a very interesting virus about 2 years ago because of its potential link to multiple sclerosis.
Yeah, so this is a much more positive story, thankfully. So Epstein-Barr virus, as we know, affects about 95% of the population in Ireland and around the world have been infected with Epstein-Barr virus. But as you said, about two years ago, there was a massive study come out of the US where they made very, very conclusive associations between individuals who are exposed to Epstein-Barr virus and then go on to develop multiple sclerosis. So there is something in the Epstein-Barr virus in that in some individuals who are genetically susceptible, or maybe they might be immunocompromised at the time when they get infected, that can tip the balance over to this neurological condition called multiple sclerosis. Now, the issue with multiple sclerosis and with Epstein-Barr virus especially is that, unlike other viruses, it actually is really quiet. When it infects you, it can cause glandular fever. We've all probably had glandular fever when we were teenagers. You feel rotten for a couple of weeks and your glands swell up. That's what happens acutely. But what Epstein-Barr virus does, when it lives in your system, it can be very, very silent. So it can get into your B cells, the cells that produce antibodies, and it can just sit there in a latent state for a very, very long time. Now, what this particular study that has found in a group in Fred Hutch Cancer Center in Seattle in the US, they published a paper in a journal called Cell Reports Medicine, which is a really big journal, really prominent journal in the field. And what they did was they basically engineered mice to produce two distinct proteins, one called GP350 and the other called GP42. Now, so to put that in context, what that means basically, people will remember from COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, the spike protein was the part of the virus that allowed it to infect cells. For Epstein-Barr virus, we're not great at knowing what is the spike protein on EBV. So what this group have done basically is they identified these two components that we now know are the key components that allow the virus to enter B cells. And why is that important? Well, it's important because if we can identify these components of the cell surface of the virus, we can generate vaccines and we can also generate antibodies targeting them. So really, really positive and really interesting finding. So really their next step, what they're trying to do with the next step would be that this would better inform how we could vaccinate. So we could potentially vaccinate the population against EBV to prevent multiple sclerosis. So, you know, absolutely incredible findings down the line.
Yeah. And the analog, I suppose, here is cervical cancer, HPV, you know, this seemingly innocuous virus that everyone gets, you know, once they reach sort of, you know, the age of, you know, sexual activity. It's everywhere, but it doesn't affect everybody in a negative way. But some people, gives them cervical cancer. And we've managed to get rid of that theoretically if people vaccinate their children.
Yep. Yeah, so absolutely. So we're just not there yet with EBV, but in the future, we should have a vaccine for this.
Which is very exciting. Our third story, Jess, has to do with something that I've always thought has been undervalued and misunderstood generally, and that is the power of small talk.
Yeah, and before we get to that story, Jonathan, can I ask you what you had for breakfast today?
I didn't have breakfast today.
You didn't have breakfast? How did that make you feel?
Hungry.
That's fair.
I guess.
that makes sense. That tracks. And so this study, it's a new study from the University of Michigan, basically looking at whether people enjoy small talk as much as they think they will. And there is, you know, there's a type of person who's like, I don't like small talk. Like, I just want to get really intense, really deep right away. And so they basically took about 1,800 people. They asked them to predict their enjoyment of specific topics of conversation and then put them in pairs, had them talk about like a specific thing, and asked them afterwards to rate their enjoyment of the conversation. And I really loved the list of small talk topics that they had for this, including things like the weather, stock market, vegan diets, Pokemon, and onions.
Those as small. It's like onions could be really, really profound.
There's a lot of layers. But so the thing that's interesting about this is that people, even if they said beforehand, oh, that's a very boring topic, I'm not going to enjoy talking about it, afterward, people's ratings of the conversations were consistently much higher than they predicted. And I think it's interesting to think about why this is, right? Thinking about how you're going to feel about the facts of a conversation, like, did we discuss the stock market or onions? Like, it's easy to make a sort of prediction of like, well, how much am I interested in that thing? But of course, a conversation isn't one person. It's the connection. It's like your engagement with the other person. It's talking. It's feeling listened to. It's maybe feeling understood. It's maybe feeling hungry. Like, just that kind of ineffable thing about conversation people like it. You know, people like talking to each other. So even if the topic is not important, it's not always about the topic. And I think it's very interesting to maybe recalibrate our expectations of what small talk is or does. I mean, as you said, like it can lead to a lot more, but even small talk by itself, it's connecting with another human being.
Totally. Dale Carnegie wrote this book called How to Win Friends and Influence People, and it's absolutely worth a read because it is really more about just connecting with people and acknowledging that they exist. And like, doors really open. Now, I have to be very mindful of this because it's not my default. My default is, how much is that? Okay, I'll take it then. Thank you, bye. And, you know, and actually I need to rewire my brain to be more small talky. But yeah, it's really fundamental to starting off having any sort of conversation with someone. Thank you very much for that, Jess. Our final story, Matthew, has to do with fluoride in the water. I mean, I don't know how we're still asking questions about this subject. I don't know how many studies we can do on it, but what was this about?
Well, it's a very interesting topic. I suppose that's why we're asking the questions. It's in the US, they've been adding fluoride to their water since the 1940s. We started the program in Ireland in the 1960s. And the whole concept was it was a public health measure to improve dental health, essentially. So at those times, kids were having, you know, tooth decay and cavities. So the idea is that you add fluoride to the water, it bolsters the enamel, this hard part of our teeth. And in recent years, and also, I mean, this is not that recent. There's been controversy since the 1950s. There was an idea that this was a communist conspiracy to impact the health of Americans. But so these things still happen. So the idea is that there was controversy that adding fluoride to the water was impacting the IQ of children. So it was impacting brain development. And so this study from the University of Minnesota did it.
That concern came from where?
Well, where did these concerns come from? Somebody just has an idea.
Someone on the internet with the crazy tin hat.
Well, one of the things, comes from some, there are some papers from India and China where they've looked at very, very high levels in groundwater. Okay, so very high levels of fluoride that's in the groundwater and the association with brain development in children. So there may be an association with very, very high levels, but these are levels off the scale. The levels we're adding to the water are very, very low. And to put that in context, it's 0.7 milligrams per liter. So that's 0.7 parts per million. So tiny, tiny amounts are all we need to bolster the enamel health of children. So the concept here was that what a group did in University of Minnesota was they tracked 10,000 people from Wisconsin and they asked a very simple question. They said, what is the IQ like in a longitudinal context? If we test the IQ in children and then monitor it when they're adults, is there any differences? And conclusively, there were no differences. So to my scientific knowledge, how do you conclude? What do you conclude with that data? You conclude that in all likelihood, 0.7 milligrams per liter, 0.7 milligrams or parts per million is safe and tolerable in the water. So, you know, we're still having these conversations. Key takeaway for the public, you know, for this is that, you know, the conversations still need to be had. You know, people should be asking these questions.
Spending money on research where the evidence base is not very high, but you have people in government, particularly in the United States, who are, you know, who are giving credence to, I don't know. Like, I mean, that doesn't seem like an enormous amount of evidence to start a population study.
No, it's not. And if you do your own diligence on this, if you look at the levels of fluoride in things like a can of Coke, you know, there's the same level of fluoride in a can of Coke as there is in water. If you go and buy your distilled water, your Evian bottle of Evian water, it's the same amount of fluoride.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the public are right to question these things. You know, we should be questioning these things all the time, but they do need to listen to
I'm being facetious. Conversations are really important. And I suppose just trust me on this hasn't worked very well in the past.
Yep.
So you're absolutely right, Matthew. Matthew Campbell and Jasmine Fairfield, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, on the way, are scientists soon to be a thing of the past? Welcome back. Now, in the coming years, I'm sure there'll be a lot of people out there who might be inclined to curse computer scientists for developing AI to the point that it has made their job obsolete. But if it makes you feel any better, it appears they are intent on doing away with their own profession as well. Jeff Kloon is SciFar AI Chair at the Victor Institute and Professor of Computer Science at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. He's at the forefront of developing an AI scientist. He joins me now. Jeff, how exactly does a scientist AI work?
So the AI scientist is a system that basically has AI doing the entire arc of what a human scientist does when they're doing scientific work. So it comes up with its own idea for how to improve a system or its own hypothesis to test. It comes up with a plan of experiments that will test that hypothesis or if that idea works. It programs or creates the software to test, you know, run those experiments. It looks at the data. It iterates a few times if it thinks it's necessary. It visualizes the data like charts and plots. It looks at those plots and says, do I actually have enough data yet to decide if this idea or this hypothesis is true or false? And then eventually it writes up the entire paper describing the results from the first word in the title to the last period in the references section. And then it does one final step. It actually conducts its own peer review where it studies how good is this science? Is it good enough to be published? And if it is good enough, it kind of returns to the human and says, hey, I've done a bunch of experiments and some scientific work. Here are my findings in a human readable form, in the form of this scientific paper.
Okay, so the idea of that was ludicrous a few years ago, but as these AI systems have become increasingly better at thinking and performing cognitive tasks, this is no longer an idea. This is actually a reality. You've actually built something that has been able to produce a paper that's been published in a scientific journal?
That's correct. Yeah, the stuff of science fiction is becoming reality at a remarkable pace. So in this case, my whole career, I've been doing neural nets for over 20 years. We've always made the joke every time we automate a little piece of the scientific process with AI, we say, one day we'll eventually have the system write the full paper. And a few years ago, we decided we think it's now possible. And so that's what we've done here. We've created AI that literally does the entire process with no humans touching the system, to go from the original idea, coming up with a creative idea, all the way through to a paper that successfully navigated peer review and actually outperformed 55% of the human-authored papers that were submitted to the same venue and got accepted and published through peer review. So it's not as good as the best human scientists or even the kind of the top tier of human scientists yet, but it is remarkable that it's even possible.
So this is, of course, limited to a few domains, right? Because not all scientific research is possible to do in the cloud.
Actually, I think this exact same playbook can disrupt and will disrupt almost every scientific discipline.
Really?
It's going to start with the places where getting experimental data automatically is really easy. So the easiest place is in a computer, or like in AI and computer science, we do our experiments within software. And so that was where we started, and that's the easiest. There are increasingly people, every day I get an email from people who are hooking these ideas up to automated laboratories, where the systems that can automatically do pipettes and test tube to automatically do experiments in synthetic biology or material science,
wow,
chemistry. And soon the system will be able to do experiments that are suggested to humans who go off and do a little bit more work and a little bit more of a complicated domain. And eventually they could be suggesting experiments for the most expensive types of experiments we have, like experiments on the Hubble telescope or CERN. So I think we're going to see things across the spectrum with the lowest hanging fruit first and increasingly into more and more difficult forms of science.
Wow, that is very interesting. First question I have to you about the methodology is the creative approach. So when we think of scientific hypotheses, a researcher comes up with an idea that they want to test. How do they do that in the real world? And how do you get an AI to do that when it's not a human?
Yeah, so actually the process is very similar. So one thing that is known, and Newton captured really well, is that scientists see further by standing on the shoulders of giants, those that came before. So scientists, human scientists, basically read what is currently known, the experiments that have already been conducted, the ideas that have been floated, and often they can then say, if that works, or if the world works this way, then I can try this idea, or what if I do that? And so it's often the case that humans will look at the same basic set of facts and ideas and independently come up with the same next idea. In fact, Newton invented calculus at the same time as Leibniz, and Darwin invented evolution at the same time as Wallace. And this happens over and over and over again. And in this case, the AI system looks at the previous discoveries. It's been trained on the entire internet. That's how things like ChatGPT work. And then you can ask the system, hey, what would be an interesting new thing to study in machine learning? What would be a way to improve the system?
And is it good at that part of the process? Because there is depending on who you ask, creativity of AI can sometimes be quite limited when it comes to the applications of, having read what's already there. Is it good at coming up with hypotheses to test?
So I would say that right now the system is pretty good. It definitely comes up with creative, interesting ideas sometimes. Not all of its ideas are great. It's kind of at the level of an early graduate student in this regard. But I actually think it's a bit of a distraction to focus on its current capabilities instead of the trend lines of how quickly it's getting better.
Yeah.
So there's a clear trend in machine learning, which is once something barely starts to work, in a few years, it's going to be jaw-droppingly good. And we've now kind of passed the Rubicon where it's barely starting to be good, and soon it will be amazing. So there are a couple of examples. I mean, many people kind of do not like the idea that AI scientists can be as creative as human scientists. Humans really love to think that we're special. Mm. We didn't want to not realize, you know, we didn't want to accept that we weren't the center of the universe. We didn't want to accept that we were related to the other animals. Mm. We didn't want to accept that we might not be the only people who can play chess and Go. And in the long march of kind of taking humans down a peg, currently people are saying, oh, AI would never be creative at scientific enterprises, and humans are the only ones that can do that. But actually, we have some evidence that the system can be creative. For example, the system produced a paper that I read, and when I read it, I was like, oh, that's actually a really creative idea. And it turned out about 2 months later, a human team of scientists released a paper that did that exact same idea, and it was celebrated by the community as an interesting novel study that advanced the field. So we have some evidence that the system can come up with ideas that humans find creative. There's also been a
study. But the AI didn't just read that paper and present it on its own.
Correct. It independently came up with it, and we can verify that because the paper came out after our system was trained and after our system produced the paper. That paper was not publicly available when our system independently came up with that idea.
So let's talk about the underlying technology. In terms of the local models that you're using, obviously you're training them yourself to some certain degree, but are you using your own LLMs, or are you accessing the sort of commercial-sized LLMs like Opus 4.6 and Claude, or the latest versions that are available commercially?
Yeah, so the AI scientist has like a complicated orchestration of a few different models under its hood.
Yeah.
And we were using models that were state of the art at that time. Mm. Already the models are way better. So even if you reran our current system with the current models, they would be way better. In fact, one of the new results in the paper that we had in Nature shows that if you kind of use models later in time, the quality of the science produced by the system just goes up and up and up because the underlying models are getting smarter and better.
Yeah. And my other hat, I do a lot of AI literacy. And I think at this particular moment in time, there is a chasm of understanding between what is possible and what people think is possible. I think a lot of people have not realized how good these models have gotten in the last 3 months. So
not only do they not realize that, I think that most people do not understand the rate of improvement. Mm. They might think that they do. They know that AI is moving fast, but they don't understand just how fast it is improving. So much so that I think the entire public has no idea just how quickly and how it's just around the corner that the pace of scientific advance is going to radically improve, driven by AI.
Yeah, and I fully agree with that, because of course, one of the things that AI can do that humans can't, and I was at the launch of Charlotte Blease's brilliant book, Dr. Bot, yesterday, where she talked about, how AI might go around solving certain health problems. But one of the things she kind of mentioned, which kind of stood out to me, is the enormous amount of medical literature that doctors are expected to keep track of. And she said, even if it was just 2% of the latest developments in, the medical literature, doctors would need to be reading 25 hours a day. And so one thing that an AI can do is take what is already known and look at other methods in other fields, other technologies, and be across those in lightning speed. And that gives AI such an incredible edge over humans in terms of joining up dots. And I presume that is one of the real powers of having this idea of an AI scientist, that it can have such a broad understanding of the latest developments literally as they happen.
Yeah, that's perfectly said. And it's not just limited to medicine. In every single scientific field, the rate of papers that come out are way higher than any human could possibly keep up with. And so every single day I see, 30 papers I should absolutely read. And of course, I can't sit around reading papers all day. I also have to do the science and be a parent. And so AI can just read all of those papers, and it doesn't have to limit itself to its own field. It can read all of the papers in all of the fields and start making these beautiful serendipitous connections across fields. And it's definitely going to outpace humanity. It already is outpacing humans in that regard.
So the next obvious question is, do we actually want this to happen, though?
Yeah, so I get asked this question a lot. And I even have a colleague of mine who has told me, publicly, I think that this work is extremely impressive, but I do not like that you are doing it. I do not like that humanity is doing it. Mm. You know, and he says, I love doing science. I want to be the explorer at the frontier that's making new discoveries. And I don't want humanity to lose its place as the engine of innovation and creativity in science. And I am very empathetic to that view, but here's my response. There's unimaginable suffering in this world. Every single day, parents are saying goodbye to their children who are dying of leukemia, and children are saying goodbye to their parents as they slide into dementia and Alzheimer's and other diseases. AI scientists will help us cure all diseases. I think that's only a matter of time. And the sooner we can eliminate that tragedy and that suffering, the better. So if the cost of eliminating the tremendous tragedy and suffering that's produced by diseases or a lack of resources, a lack of clean water, a lack of food, is that my job as a scientist is a little less rewarding because I'm not the only thing that can cure a disease, that's a cost that I think I and humanity and all scientists should be willing to pay. I do understand we will take some of the value and the pride out of the job because we are not the instrument of change. But if a disease gets cured 10 years faster because we let AI participate in its cure versus humans do it, I'd rather have the disease cured and all of the tragedy that's caused by that disease eliminated rather than letting a few humans be very, very happy that they were the ones to cure that disease.
Right. So there are a number of commentators who would say, look, I think, you know, the hype on AI is, you know, has reached a peak and it just continues to grow. The Gartner hype curve just doesn't seem to have the value that we normally expect with this. So understand that there are other people in the area of AI who feel like a lot of this is overhyped. But from your point of view, if we think about all of this, what about the concern of bias? Because while AI can be less biased in its, you know, examination of results, bias permeates all of science. And I'm just wondering, how do you account for that when you talk about, you know, an AI that can read every single paper? There's bias everywhere in language, in culture, and all of that permeates into science as well. How do we get the AI to be better than humans at impartial science?
Yeah. So quickly on the hype front, for 15 years, I have been saying I think AI is going to get much more powerful and capable. And many other people have said it's all hype and it's, you know, about to hit a wall. And it's, you know, we're just around the corner from seeing it start to fail. And I have seen repeatedly that AI continues to impress. It continues to get better. And I think that it's very clear that the trend will continue and AI will continue to progress. Mm. And many of my colleagues in the field do not see any end in sight. And we expect things, the AI, to get rapidly better. In terms of bias, there's an opportunity with AI scientists to actually do a much better job than with human scientists in terms of some dimensions of making science more reliable and more trustworthy. And a main problem with human scientists is the incentive structure. Mm. So human scientists have to get tenure, they have to get grants, they want to, you know, maybe do work that has high impact and gets on the radio. And so they tend to only publish findings that have big, exciting, sexy results.
Yeah.
If they do a study and it doesn't work, they tend to say, all right, I'm not going to spend the rest of, you know, the year publishing how that didn't work. I'm going to move on to the next thing that might work. And so we end up getting a lot. What we don't do is publish all of the experiments that didn't work, and we don't document these negative results. And we also end up kind of with things like overly hyped results. Maybe somebody does a couple experiments and they seem exciting, and they can think of a couple more experiments they should do to really make sure that's a real result. And they might just say, oh, I'm too busy to do those. But in the back of their head, they're thinking, and, you know, that could potentially disprove this result, but I don't want to take the risk because right now I have something that looks quite sexy. So AI scientists do not have to get tenure. They don't have to get grants. They're not motivated by fame and impact. And so they can be more honest. They can be more rigorous. They could spend a lot of time replicating the work of other labs to make sure that it's real, something that human scientists almost never have incentives to do. And so we could create a world in which the science we get back is much more reliable and trustworthy, at least in those dimensions. There is a world, however, in which we could do it completely wrong. We could only publish the most high-impact, sexy AI scientific results. We could incentivize the AI scientists to, like, go out and get the most high impact results because we want our system to outcompete the systems of other people and show how good it is. And then we would just kind of re-inject all of the problems we have in the current community, including the things like the replication crisis, if we don't do it right. So there's an opportunity to get way better here, but it would be kind of comical if we ended up creating all of the same problems all over again because we inject our human incentive system right into the AIs that we create.
Yeah, they are pretty convincing arguments. It'll be really interesting to see where this goes. The first peer-reviewed paper by an AI scientist has been published. It's been really interesting speaking with you, and I'm sure we'll connect again over the next couple of years. But researchers and scientists love to hear your thoughts on this work. That's Jeff Kloon. He's from SciFAR. He's the AI chair at the Victor Institute and professor of computer science at the University of British Columbia in Canada. Thank you for your time, Jeff.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay, it's time to look back at some of our stories from last week. And if you remember, we were talking about this in the newsround. A lot of people commented on it. The letter that was raised of concern to the Federal Communications Commission by 2,500 researchers from more than 30 countries who did not want orbital deployment of mirrors in space. And the idea is that you could put a mirror up in space and reflect the sunlight down to a patch of land that could be as big as a football field, or even much smaller, which is incredible to think about. Or it could be quite large, could do a whole town. And lots of astronomers and scientists said this is a bad idea. I think it's a really cool idea, but I don't think we should do it. But I think it's a really cool idea. That's why I said that last week. Aidan McKelvey, producer of the show, joins me in studio to go through some of the comments. Do you think it's a cool idea?
And this is one of those few occasions where I think you're exactly right. It's a bad cool idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of fun to think about. You know, it's very much a sort of Jim Carrey Truman Show sort of. You know, remember they did the rain shower and it followed him around.
And it's kind of it's like a lo-fi high tech. Like it's an idea that like a 2-year-old could have had.
Yeah, exactly. But actually, is kind of cool. But some people didn't like it. Brian in Dublin says, when I was in primary school, I had a teacher who told us that every single human invention had ultimately been used for evil. It was nihilistic then, and it's nihilistic now. inventions?
Yeah, that's a very glum view of human
marshmallows.
Invention.
Marshmallows have been used for evil.
Penicillin.
Spoons. Yeah. Blankets.
I thought you were going to say collar there.
No, I had to stop myself.
Imprisoning the doggo.
I don't know if it's nihilistic to think of have inventions. And there are applications for this. It's just, you know, the benefits are outweighed, it would seem, according to 2,500 researchers. But the positives are outweighed by the negatives. Another person says, they already use mirrors in this way in the Alps. This is really cool, right? So this is Peter. He sent us a link to this Wikipedia page about a town in the Alps called Viganella. I haven't heard this story. How have I not?
I know, it's unbelievable.
So listen to this. Due to the high ridge to the south, Viganella, this Alpine town, remains shadowed for 83 days per year between the 11th of November and the 2nd of February. And a giant mirror was set up in December 2006 with controlled orientation above the mountainside at 1,100 metres on the Alpe Scaiola, which consists of 14 sheets of steel which are 8 metres wide and 5 metres high. And this basically acts as a mirror that tracks the sun like a heliostat. So when the sun goes up in the sky, it continues and follows the sun and points the sunlight at the town that's in the shadow of the mountain. And it's so cool. It says here, the mirror functions as a heliostat and the mirror costs only €100,000, or approximately €540 per resident. And it means that during the day in this town, you can have reflected sunlight and it feel like the day, as opposed to constantly being in the winter for 3 months or whatever it is, nearly 3 months. That's so cool.
Yeah, now that is a good idea. The only question I would have, and I wondered, has anyone done any studies on this? You know, like you have lots of insects that are very localized in their habitat. Is there an insect in this valley that, for whatever reason, wants more darkness, or that's what it's evolved to do? And would this light be harming the insect?
I imagine, unlike our own planners, who often spend an enormous amount of time, quite rightly, doing ecological studies, I would imagine they took a quick look at it here, Italy, and they probably went, you know what? I'm sure we'll be fine.
Yeah, do you want it to be sunnier? Yeah.
Probably birds, I would imagine, would have been the most at risk, right? Is my guess from reflected sunlight. What if your flight path is there and all of a sudden this giant thing is making you think the sun is in a different direction? I don't know, maybe you're right. Maybe there are species that are affected by it. Who knows? The town was featured in a 2009 Italian-Canadian film called Lo Specchio, The Mirror, as well as the 2019 film C'è Tempo. According to a former mayor, the idea behind the project doesn't have a scientific basis, but a human one. It comes from a desire to let people socialize in winter when the town shuts down due to the cold and dark. I'd like to go there.
Yeah, I kind of think it'd be an interesting thing to go visit.
You kind of have to go between the 11th of November and the 2nd of
November. See the piles of dead birds under the mirror crashed into it.
Insects plotting. Our second story that got a lot of attention in Newsround was about toast. Someone says, everyone knows this. There's nothing new regarding toast causing cancer. My mum had a book back in the 80s entitled Foods That Cause Cancer. It's a real mum book, isn't it?
Why would you buy that book?
Foods That Cause Cancer. And the toast was prominent in that list. I stopped reading about this when I came across... Oh, I stopped reading the book when I came across fruit being classified in that way. Everything is bad for you if you take enough of it to be bad for you. So this is actually true, because there is a lethal dose for every substance that is used in food or consumption by a human being, in, you know, whether it's medicine or food. And it's called the LD50. And it's determined by calculating the amount of substance required to kill 50% of a test population. Huh. Right. So, and this could be anything. This is a toxicity. So this could be milk. It can be toast. It can be water. And everything has an LD50 amount, but essentially... If you have this amount of it, 50 people will die, and that's your LD50 amount. And so,
how many mangoes do I need to eat, or bananas, to kill them?
There is an LD50 for mangoes. I have no idea what it is. Coconuts, all that sort of stuff. You know, for the most part, it is a lot. But then there are other things where it is a little. Hence the utility of the LD50. Brian in Dublin says, I wonder if there's any evolutionary advantage to wheat in having this particular amino acid to try to kill you if it's roasted. So the point of the story was that a scientist had engineered a new toast that didn't have this acrid taste and didn't create the carcinogen that we associate from burnt toast. And so Brian is saying, I wonder if there was an evolutionary advantage to the wheat becoming cancer-creating to stop humans... harvesting it?
Cooking it, I suppose.
Yeah, well...
Incredible foresight by the wheat.
Yeah, exactly. Not only to attack those predators that harvest it, but also to know post being harvested that their bodies would then be roasted at over 70 degrees.
Evolution is incredible,
isn't it? It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. That's the anthropomorphization of evolution gets you down into these funny places. But of course, it doesn't yet work like that way. As far as we know, who knows though? More research required. Aidan, thank you very much. And that's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to producer Aidan McCovey, Rory Galvin, who was on podcasts. So just slow down there for a second. And Hugo De Silva Scott on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.